Hello and welcome to the Risk Map podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker, dialing in from London.
And I'm Michael Moran, calling in this week from Denver, Colorado. Welcome to our podcast. This week, Chuck and I are going to talk with Harrison Cheng, our senior analyst for political risk in Asia-Pac. Harrison reports from our Singapore office about the unexpected outcome of Thailand's constitutional referendum on 7 August.
Mike, we're then going to be talking with Ali Sakman, one of our resident experts on Turkey, to talk about the prospects for business there following the attempted coup in July. Turkey's economy, you'll recall, was once a regional bright spot. Ali will tell us if he thinks it can last.
Finally, we take a look at the presidential elections in Zambia, whose reputation as a stable and peaceful democracy is under significant pressure. Though we expect the incumbent president to win, there has been substantial violence in the run-up to the balloting.
Mike, you might remember the scenes of the shutdown of the airport in Bangkok in 2008. That was a pretty long time ago, especially in geopolitical terms, but it gave a lot of people a lasting new impression of politics in Thailand.
I'm joined today by Harrison Cheng in our Singapore office. Harrison is our senior analyst for Southeast Asia and one of the people who looks after Thailand for us. Harrison, we had a significant referendum on the ballot in Thailand just this past weekend on the draft constitution. Can you tell me why did the draft constitution pass despite of the lack of support from the country's two biggest political parties?
With respect to the two biggest political parties, for the supporters of the Democrat Party, their supporters, they are likely to have some issues with the military junta, but they likely backed the draft because they saw no other way to assure that elections would take place under military rule. As for those who disagreed with the draft, I think the climate of political repression likely deterred many of them from expressing their votes. I think what's important to look at is that even though the percentage of no votes was only 39%, far more people actually opposed the draft than the figures suggest. There's anecdotal evidence that many people spoiled their votes, and the number of spoiled votes was very high for this referendum, over 830,000. And this exceeded the 500,000 spoiled votes in the previous constitutional referendum, which was back in 2007. And the low turnout was also especially striking, 54.5%. This is lower than the 57% that was seen in 2007, and it also fell far below the Election Commission's predicted turnout of 70%. And these quarters who didn't turn up to vote or spoiled their votes, they were concerned about possible intimidation after the vote. And this is quite plausible because the period before the referendum had involved arrests of more than 120 people for violating campaign rules. The debate over the draft constitution's contents was also strictly limited to debates organized by the government, not by civic groups, not by political groups.
Well, it's interesting to see that high number of spoiled ballots. Harrison, the military promised elections in 2017. Does the passage of this draft constitution mean that that's going to happen?
The short answer is yes. The referendum result strengthens the prospects that elections will be held next year. We assessed previously that the junta won't hold elections until it is ensured it can control the political game from here on out. And the draft constitution was part of this game plan, essentially to break the kind of stranglehold that parties led by former Prime Minister Thaksin would be able to continue to form the government on their own as a majority government. With this draft constitution, essentially, it makes it difficult for Thaksin's parties to form the government on its own. With the public now approving the draft constitution, the junta has essentially gotten what it wants. It's able to check future elected governments without launching an outright military coup. However, one of the scenarios in which elections could be delayed is if there's serious unrest on the streets, or if there are developments related to the royal succession, which is the military's key concern. So these two rounds would give the junta the pretext to extend its rule to restore stability.
Finally, Harrison, let's get down to brass tacks for a second. What does the outcome mean for foreign investors in Thailand?
I think for foreign investors, the short-term implications, if they are concerned about, you know, operational disruptions arising from protests, from security incidents, I think they will be rather reassured. The short-term security risks are quite limited, given that the public has gone on the side of the junta on this. Those who are protesting against the junta would likely have limited public traction. However, as I mentioned, the low turnout, the large number of spoiled votes, indicate that the underlying socio-political divisions haven't really improved. So what this means is that if the junta continues to make missteps on policy or on the economy, the risk of protests could re-emerge before elections. Looking further, post-elections, we are likely to get a weak civilian government. Importantly for foreign investors, this civilian government will be vulnerable to policy-making disruptions, largely due to interference from unelected bodies. The draft constitution is going to include a military-appointed Senate, and the Senate will have veto power over certain policy decisions. Cabinet ministers who run afoul of the military royalist establishment could face heavy penalties, such as being barred from politics, being thrown out of office. We could see the whole cabinet thrown out. And there's very little room for changing the constitution. The elected government would likely want to change the constitution, but the military-appointed Senate has the power to block any such amendments. But if we look to probably even longer time frame of about 5 years, this arrangement of a managed democracy by the military is unlikely to hold indefinitely. Because groups aligned with Thaksin are likely to push for changes, they will try to line up their own people in key state appointments in order to dilute the influence of the military and the royalists. This is likely to trigger a new cycle of retaliatory moves in the form of street protests by the anti-Thaksin groups, judicial intervention by the Constitutional Court. And this leads Thailand down the same path of years-long cycle of instability. That should be quite worrying for foreign investors.
Well, Harrison, this is a really, really interesting picture. Thank you very much for the commentary on the referendum, and I'm sure we'll be talking again about the investment climate in Thailand. Until then, Harrison Chang, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. No problem.
Well, Thailand once had a reputation for being one of the more stable, peaceful, and predictable countries in Southeast Asia. Zambia, too, once had that reputation in South Saharan Africa. Now that's all in doubt as a tense election looms. Barnaby Fletcher is on top of political risk in Zambia, and he tells us that the incumbent will remain in office, but by a very slim margin. Hi, Barnaby.
Hello.
So, Barnaby, what are we looking at in the 11 August election in Zambia?
As you mentioned, Zambia has a fairly enviable democratic record. There's been two democratic and peaceful transfers of power between opposing parties since its return to multi-party democracy in 1991, which may not sound like much, but it's a record that in the Southern African development community is beaten only by Mauritius. This election, however, poses a number of challenges. What you have is two main parties, the incumbent Patriotic Front and the main opposition United Party for National Development, who have very distinct regional and ethnic divides in their voting support bases. So this obviously creates a lot of tension. The campaign period has arguably been the most violent that we've seen in Zambia. There's been numerous incidences of clashes between rival supporters, of political rallies turning violent, of police allegedly using heavy-handed tactics towards opposition parties, and the ruling party accusing the main opposition's vice president of trying to organize and train militias.
So what do we see as an outcome here?
So in terms of the outcome, we expect a narrow victory for the ruling Patriotic Front and their presidential candidate and current president, Edgar Lungu. But this victory will be very narrow, and especially in the presidential poll, a new constitutional amendment approved in January means that the president has to be approved by an absolute majority. If this is not achieved in the first round of the presidential poll, there will be a second round. And this period in between the first round and the second round of the presidential polls will have a very high likelihood of violence and social unrest. In the 2006 and the 2007 elections, delays in announcing the results combined with rumors of vote rigging caused large-scale riots in Lusaka, in Kitwe, and Ndola. In this election, given that allegations of vote rigging have already been made by the opposition party and given the acrimonious environment in which the campaigns have been conducted, we are highly likely to see similar unrest occur.
Well, Barnaby Fletcher, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mike, governance in sub-Saharan Africa remains a major challenge almost permanently. I look forward to hearing from Barney about this again soon. You can say this much, though, about elections. Most of the time, they're pretty predictable. What happened in Turkey in the middle of July, however, was a genuine shock to a part of the world that's already had its fair share of geopolitical disturbances. But will Turkey steady its political culture, its economy, its investment climate? I'm joined today by Ali Sukman, our associate analyst for Turkey. Ali, the coup in Turkey happened on the 15th of July, but we haven't really talked about it in the Risk Map podcast. With a little bit of hindsight, let's now look forward. What's the outlook for general political stability in Turkey for the near term?
Over the next few weeks, there's going to be an environment of political reconciliation between the opposition and the government. There's going to be a general de-escalation of tensions, or at least efforts to de-escalate tensions. This is because the coup attempt has revealed a potential for deterioration in the overall political and security environment. The government is undertaking efforts to reduce political tensions by reaching out to the opposition. We're going to see more initiatives of the government to hold joint demonstrations with the opposition party leaders or try to de-escalate tensions by avoiding bringing up contentious issues. This is going to be a defining factor of the coming few weeks.
Moving on, what do you think the situation is going to be for Turkey's external relations? Turkey is a member of NATO. Turkey is in constant talks with the European Union. It's trying to cooperate militarily with the United States in the Middle East. What's the foreign policy outlook for Turkey?
The failed coup attempt has had an impact on the Turkish foreign policy that is going to be felt over the next months. The immediate short-term impact was that the tensions between the Turkey and the United States have increased due to the U.S.-based cleric Fethullah Gulen, who the government accuses to be instigating the coup, resides in the United States. This is going to be a factor that will drive the U.S.-Turkey relations in the coming weeks. And government officials from the United States are planning visits to Turkey. John Kerry has just announced that he'll be visiting Turkey at the end of this month. So I think there will be efforts from the side of the United States to improve the relations. And I think also that from the perspective of relations with the EU, there aren't going to be any important developments until late September, October, when the migration agreement between Turkey and EU is going to have a final negotiations round. But up until then, I would expect that the relations between Turkey and EU would stay relatively stable.
Ali, finally, let's talk about the business environment. Turkey has always presented a reasonably favorable investment climate among emerging markets. It's always had a reasonably strong and stable growth rate and has been a lot more attractive than several other emerging markets. What has the attempted coup done to the business environment in Turkey, and what's the risk profile looking like for foreign direct investment?
In terms of its impact on the business environment, the physical operational impact of the coup attempt has been limited. The only operational disruptions that have resulted from the coup attempt have been due to the state of emergency, with some increased waiting times for persons traveling through customs due to security checks, as well as some restrictions on transportation and use of explosives, which is being used in certain sectors such as mining. Other than that, there hasn't been an important immediate impact on a coup attempt on the business environment.
So do you feel that foreign investment and foreign capital is still welcome in Turkey?
Foreign investment and foreign capital is still welcome in Turkey. The reason is that Turkey has a large current account deficit that it hasn't been able to narrow. And the foreign investments, especially foreign direct investments, is an important way of addressing this economic structural weakness. And for this reason, the government is likely to remain open and friendly to foreign investment and prioritize improving the business environment once the fallout from the coup attempt has ended.
So from the perspective of the foreign business person, Ali, Turkey remains a relatively stable place to invest.
That's correct.
Ali, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Chuck, thanks. Before we close out this edition of the podcast, there are a few other issues on our list for the next couple of weeks.
Malaysia's 1MDB scandal unbelievably continues to grow legs. We've got an eye on whether Malaysia will be the scene of a series of corruption crackdowns in the near future.
And we'll find out what the Bank of England's decision to lower rates for the first time since 2009 tells us about the influence of the EU referendum on the UK economy. We'll be watching how financial circles weigh Brexit in the weeks to come.
Mike, that's it for this week's edition of the Risk Map podcast. Thanks very much for the chat, and to all of our listeners, thanks very much for dialing in. Talk to you again soon from London.
And from the United States, bye for now.